There are many places around the world that we commonly associate with volcanoes and volcanic activity, but there are some that aren't as familiar to most of us. And one of those places is actually Australia. And one of the ways that we can learn about the volcanic activity and the history of volcanism here is actually through integrating indigenous local knowledge with physical science. And so I'm very excited to bring on today to talk about this and a number of things, Associate Professor Heather Handley, all the way from Australia, joining us from Sydney. Hi there, Heather.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you so much for joining us today. There's a fantastic range of things we're able to talk about today, and I'm really excited to hear about some of the things you've got upcoming, some of your past work. But it'd be great to hear just a little bit more about yourself, how you've got to where you are today, and then some of the current things you're working on.
Yeah, when I was 5 years old, really, I think my geological curiosity started. I'm originally from South Yorkshire in the UK, and we used to go fossil hunting with my parents on the Jurassic Yorkshire coastline. Yeah, and it was there that I discovered my love of finding fossils. And so, yeah, I think that's where it all started for me. And then again, through family, really, on our holiday to Tenerife, the island of Tenerife, when I was 9 years old, you know, we took away from the beaches, hired a car and explored the island. And that's when I got to see my first active volcano. And I was just absolutely mesmerized by this giant mountain that was capable of so much, you know, power and destruction that was sat so quietly in front of us, and this moon-like landscape of lava flows sat in front of me. And so I think it was that that made me think, you know, how do these things work? How does the earth work? And start to think, you know, how do you turn a living animal into a piece of rock? You know, when I was little, and it started to really spark my interest. And then from there, you know, at school, we didn't offer geology for us to study. So, but I knew I liked physical geography and I liked physical chemistry. And so I thought geology might be something that I would find interesting. And at uni in Edinburgh, I went to do actually physical geography with geology. But as soon as I got into geology, I knew that that was 100% for me. And I guess that's where it, and, you know, never stopped since then. But I never really set out to be a scientist or follow a science career. But after the degree, I saw a PhD advertised for the geochemistry of Indonesian volcanoes. And I'd spent quite a bit of time in Southeast Asia while I was an undergraduate, you know, traveling around doing humanitarian projects. And I really loved the region. And I'd liked the physical, you know, the chemistry aspects of geology. So this just sounded like the most amazing PhD. And I was lucky to be offered it. And then from there, I carried on in geochemistry, and I moved to Australia in 2007. To do more research on volcanoes in the kind of Asia Pacific region. And then I've kind of like my career then probably took a little bit of a turn, and I've gone a bit more into the social sciences side of volcanoes, and really more about the, you know, the human impacts and human interaction with volcanoes. And so I started off very much a kind of hard rock geochemist, but I've ended up now kind of moving a bit more towards, you know, people's interaction and impact and resilience.
Fantastic. And so what did you know about, you know, Australia's history of volcanism before you moved out there?
Yeah, I knew very little, so I have to admit. So I was very much more interested in, you know, the areas around Australia. You know, we're actually surrounded by, you know, Indonesia, Vanuatu, Tonga, New Zealand. We've got lots of volcanically active areas right around the kind of north and eastern side of Australia, and hadn't really paid attention. You know, I was very much interested in very active volcanoes that are visibly doing something. But then I slowly started to get interested and wonder a bit more about this. So when you think about Australia, you think about, you know, koalas, dusty red landscapes, beaches, kangaroos, but you wouldn't necessarily think about volcanoes. But in Australia, actually, we've got one of the longest continental volcanic belts in the world. It's over 4,000 kilometers long, stretching down the east coast of Australia. So we've got a very rich volcanic history. And then it started to really ignite my curiosity to learn a bit more about, you know, why do we have volcanoes in this middle of a tectonic plate, you know, in Australia? And what was going on, like, recently? Why were some so recently active?
Yes, how recent is the volcanic activity actually on the mainland?
So the last volcanic eruptions on the mainland of Australia are thought to be between around 5,000 to 7,000 years old. So this is in the southeast of the country. So we've got a volcanic field. So this is an area of, it's not like, you know, a typical volcano that you think of as a big, pointy, conical volcano. These are volcanic fields. So they're lots of little volcanoes in a big, wide region of activity. And the field, the new volcanic province in Southeast Australia, stretches from Melbourne all the way across the border. So that's in Victoria, all the way across the border into South Australia at Mount Gambier. And it's at Mount Gambier, they think the last volcanic eruption was about 5,000 years ago. And then in the northeast of the country, we have a volcano that was originally dated, you know, by different techniques, all the techniques of potassium argon, to be about 50,000 years old. But more recent dating by argon-argon methods has shown that that volcano is possibly 7,000 years plus or minus two. So that puts these volcanoes, these two, you know, both in the northeast of the country and the southeast of the country, in this framework of what we really consider to be active. You know, it was an eruption within the last 10,000 years. So there is potential in the future. You know, these, some of these fields, the New Volcanics Province, has been active for over 4.5 million years. So, you know, the last eruption was only 5,000 years ago. You know, why is it going to stop now that we're just more aware of, you know, of the volcanic landscapes around us? So there is potential in future for future volcanic activity.
Wow, that's quite a significant change in the conception of, you know, how recent the activity is, from dating of 50,000 back all the way down to just 7,000 years ago, and also in terms of human history.
Yes, exactly. So if we, you know, if we think there are different estimates for how long humans have been in on the continent of Australia. And so present estimates suggest anywhere between 50,000 and 65,000 years that, you know, humans first made it across onto the continent. And so in that time frame, from the dates we have available, and we don't have all the dates, and some are really kind of estimates still, but from the dates that we have so far, there's probably been at least 13 volcanoes that were possibly witnessed by humans that have erupted in Australia over that time frame.
Wow. So some of the work you're doing is actually trying to integrate that knowledge into either, well, by the sounds of it, quite sparse physical science records. So what have we been able to learn through, you know, incorporating like this local indigenous history? Is it well recorded?
Yes. Well, so we're very, you know, Australia has one of the longest lived cultures with rich traditional knowledge systems. But obviously, unfortunately, when it was colonized, there was a lot of displacement and dislocation. And as a result, you know, there was a lot of loss of that cultural knowledge. So we are more limited in scope, you know, and obviously some groups would not have wanted to pass that on to, you know, missionaries or pastoralists, you know, people that were there that actually recorded these kind of information in early, you know, in the 19th century, in the 1800s, when I guess people arrived from Europe into Australia. So we've lost a lot of the information, but we do still have information that's been passed down. You know, these are our best eyewitness accounts of volcanic eruptions on the mainland. These are people that, you know, the culturally were there when they witnessed these and have passed that knowledge on for hundreds of generations, because it was important, obviously. You know, these were events that could cause harm, and so, you know, that were dangerous. And so it was very important for survival to pass that knowledge on down through generations. And so it became embedded in oral traditions. And so, yeah, one thing that I'm really interested in doing is working to integrate, you know, just widen our broader sources of knowledge of volcanoes and the impacts on people and the environment. And in Australia, one of the ways we can do that is by integrating with knowledge of past. You know, if we take them as eyewitness accounts, obviously there's many generations down that things may have changed a little bit, you know, along the way from different influences. But what we can find from that is there are situations where we don't have great dates. So for example, in Mount Gambier and Mount Shank in the New Volcanic Province, they're very close to each other, these two volcanoes. They're thought to have, we don't necessarily have a good time frame, but they're the youngest ones. So somewhere around 5,000 years ago, but we don't know which one came first. But the local Aboriginal people there have an oral tradition that talks about making ovens. So first of all, they made it in an older volcano, Mount Muirhead. And then, you know, the evil spirit came and basically the volcano erupted. So they moved their oven and their camp to Mount Shank. And then there, you know, the evil spirit came, the bird shrieked, which is the bullin, and then they moved their ovens to Mount Gambier. So by taking the information in the oral tradition, that can suggest that there's a relative timing, you know, of events, that activity moved from Mount Shank to then Mount Gambier, which we can't necessarily ascertain from the scientific information available. We have some paleomagnetic information that shows the eruptions were probably about 300 years apart, but we don't know in which way they were apart. So that's one way that oral traditions can, you know, give information. And the other way is through, you know, the information that's provided in the events. So in Northeast Queensland, there's a, you know, an explosive Mar volcano that occurred there somewhere probably around 13,000-18,000 years ago. And what we have there is an oral tradition that tells the story of the eruption, you know, the events that happened and how it caught people by surprise, you know, and they basically were fatally, you know, wounded or injured or died from this event. And so what we can gather from that is that the warning times between the eruption, you know, that happened, you know, we've got, you know, messages about the sky going a different color, about the ground, about the, you know, things that have happened. And they interpreted that into their own, you know, beliefs and understanding at the time. But the messages are still there about the volcanic events. And so we know there that the people had very little warning of the eruption that was coming, because the people and the village and the camp fell into the volcano. So, and people were lost. So there's a lot of really rich stories of volcanic activity in the past. And we can decipher from that, you know, with our, I guess, you know, I am a native English speaking Western trained scientist. So I have my own, you know, biases or interpretation of these traditions, but we can still gather a lot of information from these traditions and combine that with the scientific knowledge to really improve our understanding of these volcanic systems and their impacts on people and the environment.
Wow, there's so much to unpack in all of this. And one of the things that's really jumped out to me there, as you say, is the importance of just such small observations, but such important observations. And one of those being warning times.
Yeah.
So, because it's not something that we normally preserve in, even in the historical record, is, you know, the lead up time and the warnings to eruptions, whether that's swarms of earthquakes, changes in the ground activity. We can monitor those things now, amazingly, with satellite data and ground-based instruments. But when we go back through the geologic record for past eruptions, we rarely capture that information apart from maybe in crystal chemistry and sometimes. But to have that actually recorded through thousands of years of oral tradition is just incredible and so useful for thinking about potential further hazards.
It is, and what I'm trying to do also is those kind of more crystal histories and that kind of mineralogical study. So part of the work I'm doing, that I've been doing with a postdoctoral researcher, is looking at ascent timescales, and I have a master's student working on this as well. So a lot of the volcanoes in the New Volcanic Province and some in the Northeast carry, you know, these fragments or chunks of the earth mantle to the surface. You know, literal chunks of the earth mantle, and it's amazing to think that a volcanic system can carry pieces of the earth's upper mantle, you know, 30, 40 kilometers all the way to the surface. And obviously to do that, the magma has to move fast, or these heavy dense chunks are going to settle back down. So one thing we are doing as well to kind of complement the indigenous records and then any other information we can get is to look at the ascent timescales that we can calculate from the size of this xenolith. So basically you've got to move this big heavy thing. So if you imagine dropping a pebble into a cylinder of honey or water, it's going to sink down. And that's what it would do if you dropped a xenolith in the magma. It would just sink down these, you know, foreign fragments of mantle. So the magma has to move fast from below to keep this thing kind of floating in the magma to the surface. And so what we're doing is both from the size and, you know, what the actual physical characteristics of the xenoliths are that we find in the rocks at the surface. We're trying to work out ascent timescales so we know how much, you know, that translates really to a warning time, because, you know, if you're moving from 35, 40 kilometers depth to the surface in a matter of hours or days, you know, you're not going to get much warning time, you know, at the surface. You know, if you think about where the earthquakes might start to occur in the more shallow levels, it's going to be moving really fast at that stage. And then the other one is, yeah, looking at the crystal histories. So in the same way that, you know, the tree rings might tell you about the environment when a tree grew, you know, it's the precipitation or the temperature, you know, what the environment was like when that tree grew from the tree rings. It's the same with the volcanic crystals, and they record or the memory of, you know, their journey to the surface. So we're trying to take a lot of different approaches to try and understand and really decipher, you know, if something's going to happen again, you know, what's it likely to result in? How much warning time might we get? Because to be honest, Australia doesn't really have any preparedness for volcanic eruptions, both inside or really outside. You know, we monitor the volcanic ash from the, you know, the the volcanic ash for the aviation warnings, but that's really about it at the moment at present.
As you say, just based on very recent history, there is almost the perception of there's no need to have, you know, volcanic hazard warnings or systems in place. But by learning more about the systems you have on the mainland and even elsewhere, it's something that's needed. So you talk about these volcanic fields, you know, they're not obvious volcanoes that most people might perceive elsewhere around the globe. And these are usually quite sporadic. You talked about that from being the northeast all the way down to the southern part of this volcanic chain. So is there a need to really try and have as much coverage as possible of this entire volcanic terrain to learn more about all of the systems, not just the ones that are most recent, because it could potentially happen anywhere?
Yeah, I guess the longevity of some of these individual volcanic fields is, you know, vast in terms of millions of years. I think one of these volcanic fields was active over 20 million years, one in New South Wales. But I think those two areas are the main areas, you know, to look for the future. But what we don't have even in those areas is a really good understanding of the ages of all the volcanoes. So in the newer volcanic province in the southeast, there's over 400 monogenetic, polygenetic-ish volcanoes. So volcanoes that are quite small and didn't have very long-lived, you know, eruptions, kind of died out, magma supply was quite short. But we've had over 400 eruptions in one single field, and we have at least 50 volcanic fields, I think, down the east coast of Australia. And I would say probably that one in the southeast, and maybe one or two in the northeast would be the ones to watch. And based on the, you know, if you just imagine you've got 400 volcanoes, it's been active for say 4.5 million years, that gives you an average recurrence kind of time frame of about 12,500 years for an eruption. But we know volcanoes don't sit there on their timer. You know, it's been 5,000 years since the last one. It's not going to be 7,000 years exactly till the next one. It could be longer, or it could actually be shorter. So things can happen in clusters, or there can be long periods of time in between. So we really need actually a better understanding of the ages. But, you know, there are challenges. You know, if you think in the tropical north Queensland, you know, all the rocks, it's very hard to kind of get opportunities for dating because the rocks are so weathered. And, you know, I've been collecting samples. You cut through, you know, with a saw, the sample, and you find this tiny little bit of core in the middle that's not, you know, being altered or weathered. And it's quite hard sometimes, you know, to get the right samples to be able to get the accurate dates.
Yeah, as you said, nature's almost your worst enemy when it comes to actually learning more about the natural environment.
Yeah, exactly.
And then even thinking about, you know, trying to get a picture in my head of what some of these systems look like. You talked about, you know, your experience in the Canary Islands at the beginning of this. And if you go around those islands, you see these, you know, these cones, the perfect little volcanic cones scattered all over the place. You'll see them in Hawaii. You can see them out in Arizona. There's so many different places where you get these little, as you said, monogenetic single eruption systems everywhere. But the older you go into the systems, the more that nature takes over from weathering, erosion, plant growth, vegetation. And I imagine a lot of the systems are unrecognizable as volcanic, even to the people who live just down the road.
Yeah, so we've got, I think in Australia in that way, we're very lucky because we've got some volcanoes that, you know, look like beautiful little volcanoes. I know Mount Elephant would be one of them. Mount Shank would be another in the new volcanic province, some of my favorite little volcanoes. We also have big central volcanoes. So in addition to the volcanic fields, we also have what we call these central volcanoes, you know, based on the fact that the eruption was really coming from a central part. And a lot of these were big shield volcanoes, and that they were thought more to be related to kind of, you know, Hawaiian style hotspot activity. But some of those, you know, that were 20 million years old now have eroded, like, you know, down to levels where we get a beautiful view into the plumbing systems of these volcanoes, you know, the bits that are left, you know, they're more resistant to weathering, the plumbing systems are getting revealed of these through this erosion. So we've got, you know, old, you know, tens of million years old volcanoes that we can see into the inner workings of, but we've also got these younger volcanoes that still look like, you know, they're scoria cones, and they're clearly scoria cones. They're only, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of years old. So they're quite well preserved still. But what I think people, at least in the general public, you know, they're used to seeing that typical image of a volcano, this conical, you know, kind of Mayon or Fuji, or, you know, these kind of very impressive, tall, you know, strata volcanoes. And in the new volcanic province, you know, we have a lot of mar volcanism. So we get a lot of, you know, just holes in the ground filled with water that just looks like lakes. And so I think that's kind of hard for some people to really see that these are a volcano, because they're used to seeing that you kind of a positive feature in the landscape and not really a negative one. But that Mount Gambier one that was about 5,000 years ago was thought to be, you know, a fairly significant eruption. So there was a study there that worked out, you know, the volcanic explosivity index that we measure volcanoes on, which runs from, you know, 0 to 8, where 0 would be something, you know, easy to walk away from, like a lava, slow moving lava flow. And then 8 is our super volcanic eruption. And the Mount Gambier eruption was calculated or estimated to be a VEI-4. So, you know, that's similar. So it was a phreatic magmatic eruption. It was where water and magma interacted and made it more explosive, you know, similar to the Icelandic eruption in 2010, the Grand Plains across Europe. So these weren't, you know, even though they were even little volcanoes, some of them still had a punch and would have made, you know, a significant impression on the landscape and the people at the time.
Yeah, wow. It's just putting that into perspective, thinking about potentially, you know, what could happen in the future. How do you find that this plays into, you know, local and education outreach? I know you do a lot of science communication with the Australian communities and with schools. How do you find the public perception of volcanism? Is it something that's surprising to most people? Is it well taught, or does it have to be, you know, taught by scientists coming in doing outreach?
Yeah, so I think that the overall general public, you know, they're not really aware of that Australia has volcanoes, definitely not aware that we might have active volcanoes. Some of that comes through the communication that scientists are giving to the public, and the outward facing information is not, we're not on the same plane. So some scientists are saying, you know, it's really unlikely and it's never going to happen. Others are saying, oh, it could happen tomorrow. And so we're not on the same plane as scientists in our messaging. And I think that probably doesn't help in the terms of our outreach of, you know, what is active, what is an active volcano even is not clearly communicated in the general public. But what we've seen is I've started working with social scientists to really find out what the public perception is about, you know, volcanic hazards in Australia, the risk from internal and external volcanic eruptions, and just their understanding of, you know, our preparedness. And so I've got about 283 surveys in so far. I'm hoping to get a few more yet before we close it. But what you can see from that is that only about 4% of said that Australia is well prepared for a volcanic eruption. They all recognize they're not really concerned about volcanoes or volcanic events, but they do, I think over 80% thought that Australia could be impacted by a volcano from outside Australia. So we have a really mixed understanding of, they're not really concerned about it in their everyday. And that's, you know, quite rightly, they're more concerned about bushfires, droughts, floods, you know, the things that Australians encounter much more frequently. But, you know, we also have earthquakes, and there have been some significant earthquakes in recent time that have caused a lot of damage. So we had one in 89 in Newcastle, and these were a magnitude 5 volcanoes and then earthquakes. And then we had another one only last September last year that was, I think, a 5.6 magnitude earthquake. So we do get, you know, they do have some exposure to, you know, less frequent but higher risk events. But yeah, I think volcanoes are just so far from everybody's minds because they're dealing with much more, you know, much more frequent other natural hazards, that it's not surprising really that it's not something on the agenda.
Yes, exactly. And but a lot of what you do as well is you know, incorporating this kind of citizen science approach, where you're using data and thoughts and experiences from people within within Australia or outside to try and improve that knowledge, to almost help the public at the same time. So you've been involved recently with some work with the Tonga Geological Services, correct? In doing some citizen science to think about, is it ash collection from the Hunga Tonga eruption?
Yeah, so what we tried to do after the eruption occurred in Tonga in January of this year in 2022, we wanted to try and see if we could collect some information, but we didn't want to impose upon, you know, Tongans that were trying to go through recovery and through the trauma of experiencing, you know, and the fear of what was going to happen with the tsunami and the ashfall. And so we were trying to think about, you know, what information we could get to better our understanding of this event, because it was quite unusual from many different aspects. And one of those was to get more information about the thicknesses of the ash and the type of the ash, and, you know, get some descriptions of that before, you know, it gets washed away by rain or in the cleanup process. And so we worked, developed a citizen science project. So with collaborators, Tongan collaborators in Australia, with volcanologists, with people who work in, you know, risk in Australia and with the Tongan Geological Services and people and the Meteorological Services in Tonga and Australia to try to make a citizen science project where we get the local people of Tonga to measure, you know, the thicknesses. So we're trying to say, you know, if you've got a ruler or something, but if not, just use a kind of, you know, a soft drink can that we know the standard size of. So we can just, you know, you can put that in the ash, take a photo, you know, and give us some sort of textual description of the ash. So I'm not quite sure what kind of response. We've not collated the final responses yet. And the idea was to post it to social media so that it's a useful, you know, it'd be there for everybody to use, you know, not just for, you know, for us, for our own projects. But yeah, so that would be a resource there for everyone.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, for the people of Australia, you know, you're situated in a part of the globe which is surrounded by quite frequent volcanic activity. And this recent eruption in Tonga is one fairly large example of that. So also from, you know, educating Australians about volcanic activity in surrounding areas such as New Zealand, Vanuatu, and in Indonesia, it probably helps for the perception for potential volcanic hazards on the mainland in Australia as well.
Yeah, it does. And I think that, you know, the external aspects of volcanoes that from outside Australia could affect Australians is really important, both from, you know, the impacts that can be felt on Australia, but also, you know, a lot of Australians travel overseas and are tourists in volcanically active regions and go, you know, to sightsee and to active volcanoes. And so I think having a, you know, a better understanding about, you know, if I'm going to go to see an active volcano, what should I be, you know, which, you know, monitoring authorities should I check in with, you know, what should I be looking for, you know? So I think just being having a general higher sense of awareness of volcanoes and volcanic activity would be really beneficial. And the other thing is, you know, even volcanoes in Chile have impacted Australia because of the way that the atmospheric, you know, circulation works. So we've had situations in the past in the 1930s, 1991, I think 2011, where ash from volcanoes, you know, kind of volcanic explosivity index 5 eruptions in Chile, ash has moved over and come across Australia and affected, you know, aviation and closed airports or cancelled flights. And so it's not only, you know, even those ones that are closest to us that can even affect us, you know, even those ones further away can as well.
Yeah, it really just shows about the local reach and things like that. And also thinking about that, as you were talking about earlier, about indigenous knowledge as well as the local volcanism, is there anything about, you know, other larger eruptions from further away that's also recorded within those traditions? Because you get situations, you know, where extremely large eruptions are recorded in other countries on the other side of the world from, as you said there, you know, atmospheric effects and small amounts of ashfall affecting vegetation, those sorts of things. Is that something that's also kept within this oral history?
So far in the oral traditions that I know, I've not seen records of external events that have impacted, but they have a very rich cultural history of passing on knowledge about natural hazards. So whether it's earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanic eruptions, meteorite impacts, you know, all of these events have been recorded through oral traditions and passed down through generations. But there is physical evidence in Australia. So through, you know, kind of ash that has fallen into actually in the northeast of the country into actually a mar. So volcanic ash from outside the country fell into a volcanic mar inside the country.
That's not helpful for scientists.
So, you know, when you core through the volcanic mar and you look at the sedimentation, you know, the records that are holding, you know, this mar formed, it formed a lake, you know, things fell on top, settled down to the bottom. And over time you build up this sedimentary record in the bottom of the mar. And so there is a study that has found, you know, foreign pieces of ash and this cryptotephra within a mar lake in the northeast. So they think, the scientists of that study thought it probably came from Papua New Guinea. But, you know, there were so many similarities with different places in Indonesia, PNG, possibly New Zealand. It's hard to say where it came from. But it just shows that there is cases where volcanic ash, and there was, you know, a case from Krakatoa where, you know, people in Western Australia got rained on with ash from the Krakatoa eruption Krakatoa eruption in 1883. So there are cases in the past where we do know that volcanic ash from other places has fallen as well as affected, you know, a kind of higher level processes in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it just shows the complexity of looking back at some of these records. Even when you're right next to a volcano, not all you know, looking at the ash records from that volcano, not everything you're looking at is actually from that source.
Yeah, and I think in places like, you know, really active places like Indonesia and New Zealand, you know, it must be a real challenge there when you've just got multiple volcanoes erupting at different times and trying to decipher through that record, you know, is it a change in chemistry of your own volcano you're studying, or is it, you know, from a neighboring one that's kind of fell on top of the sequence that you're looking at?
Absolutely. And just what you said that, you know, about the indigenous knowledge, I'm just thinking about the timescales and the number of generations that this oral history is held onto. And it's just astounding how rich and alive those records are kept just through oral tradition. Is everything through oral tradition, or is it that also, you know, pictorial and artistic representation that's preserved as well through, say, petroglyphs or...
So they do, you know, they do have rock art, and they do, you know, they inscribe stones with, I've seen a lot more in the kind of, you know, in terms of astronomical events. And so in terms of, you know, on the rocks, I've not seen anything referring to volcanoes recorded through other means other than the oral traditions, but they did have multiple ways, you know, to kind of pass on that knowledge. And they also had laws in place that, you know, to help preserve the accuracy of the information being passed on from one generation to the next. So yeah, but it's amazing that some of these were passed on for, you know, at least 200 generations, and that, you know, and that continues today.
And so is that working directly with the current indigenous communities today to basically access that information and knowledge?
Yeah, so there's different sources. Some of the sources are literate sources, but they are of their own, you know, they have limitations because they were recorded by colonists, and they were, so these ethnographic sources were colonists that came and, you know, may have spent, you know, 35 years were in a missionary working with Aboriginal people and learned their customs, traditions, languages, and then recorded them. Yeah, and then there's obviously ways to work with, you know, Indigenous people of the present. And so I'm collaborating with someone from there's an extremely important site down in the New Volcanics province from Bujibin Volcano, and it's a cultural landscape there. It's got, you know, World Heritage status. And so, you know, working together with them to further our understanding of events as well.
Wow, fantastic. So I think it's so important that we're seeing this in a number of places around the world where there's this, you know, increasing interest to make sure we incorporate local communities and indigenous knowledge into the physical science and the local social science, so we can better build a picture of how we can, well, one, think about our history, but also going into our future in preparing society for potential future events. So it's really, really fascinating and important work, I think, that's being done in these areas. Well, this has been absolutely fantastic. I've learned so much myself. I know there's, I'm probably going to go away from this talk and start looking at all these volcanoes that you've mentioned. And I hope others do the same. Is there a place where people can then maybe look at some of your recent work or some of the projects you're working on?
Yeah, so I've got my website that details some, and we've also got, I can provide some links, you know, to kind of 3D models of some of the volcanoes if that's helpful. So my favorite, Manshank, in the New Volcanic Province, we've got like a 3D model we can give you the link to for that. But I'm also writing a book on Australia's volcanoes, and so I'll be covering all of these aspects in that. So it's work in progress at the moment, but I'm hoping to finish it this year, and hopefully then it'll be out next year. So it's kind of a popular science and history. It's really telling the history of Australia through the eyes of a volcano.
Oh, well, that's just fantastic. And please let us know when that comes out, because we will absolutely share it related to this episode.
Thank you. Thank you.
So just to finish up today, through everything that you've done, is there one particular memory or experience that's really stuck in your mind from working with volcanoes over the years?
Yeah, I think it would have to be the first time that I saw Yasser Volcano in Vanuatu. And I think this is a real, you know, everybody's so impressed whenever they go to Yasser Volcano on the island of Tanna in Vanuatu. We'd gone to do some work. I was actually helping a colleague do some work on waters in Ambrim. So Ambrim's another island just to the north, kind of in Vanuatu. And there's the volcano that just throws out a huge amount of sulfur dioxide and, you know, hazardous gases. You know, it's a big plume all the time. And the locals were concerned that it would be contaminating the rainwater, because they all have drinking water that comes from rainwater catchment. And so, we were there to kind of test the water. And while we're there, he said, you know, we're so close to Yasser. Why don't we go for a day trip to Yasser? So we jumped on this tiny plane, you know, to go down just for a day and just experience, you know, the volcano that erupts, you know, every 10 minutes. So it's kind of, you know, chugging away all the time. And then every 10 minutes, there's this big boom, you know, so you feel the earth, you feel the shock, the big boom and a big shower of molten rock flying out. You know, and it's that moments when you think, oh, you know, are we going to be okay? You know, before it kind of turns over to see where the trajectory of the volcanic bombs are going to land. But there's some accommodation there. And I think it was the accommodation that was really, you know, it's something that always stick in my mind. So quite close to the volcano at the base, there's an accommodation there. And, you know, you go in and it was like we were sharing a dorm and there was no glass in the windows. But there were curtains in front of the windows and we were on these like little rickety wooden, camping beds. But at night, you know, you're laid in bed trying to sleep and every 10 minutes, literally, you know, the ground shakes, the bed rocks, the boom goes, the shockwave blows the curtains. And then you can hear it like pat, 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 as all the volcanic bombs land. So I think that would have to be, you know, one of my most memorable volcanic experiences. I'll never forget that one.
A complete sensory experience.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that with us today. And thank you for joining us for this episode, Heather. And also best of luck with writing the rest of your book. I'm sure we'll all be very excited to see it when it comes out.
Thanks very much, Sam.
Thanks, Heather.
Thanks.